Welcome back to Russian Roulette, the podcast from the Russian Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I'm your host, Jeff Mankoff. This week on Russian Roulette, I am joined by Ambassador James Dobbins, Howard Schatz, and Ali Wine from the RAND Corporation. They are the authors of a new report called Russia is a Rogue, Not a Peer. China is a Peer, Not a Rogue. Different challenges, different responses. We're going to talk about how the Chinese and Russian challenges to U.S. interests differ, how they're the same, and what we can do about it. It's an interesting and provocative report, and I think the conversation was equally interesting and provocative, and I hope you'll enjoy it. Let's get started. Welcome back to Russian Roulette. I'm joined in the studio today by James Dobbins, Howard Schatz, and Ali Wine, who are the authors of a new report called Russia is a Rogue, Not a Peer. China is a Peer, Not a Rogue, published by the RAND Corporation. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for having us.
So I like this report because it addresses the Sino-Russian challenge to the United States, which if you read the national security strategy should be our top priority. But it does it in a way that tries to disaggregate the nature of that challenge and point out the ways in which Russia and China are different. So if Russia is a rogue, what does that mean exactly?
Well, I think there's a couple of sentences in the report that highlight this. The report says that both countries seek to alter the status quo, but only Russia has attacked neighboring states, annexed conquered territory, supported insurgent forces seeking to detach yet more conquered territory. Russia assassinates its opponents at home and abroad. Russia interferes in foreign elections, subverts foreign democracies, and works to undermine European and Atlantic institutions. In contrast, China's growing influence is based largely on more positive measures, trade, investment, and development assistance.
So I don't want to focus too much on China because after all, this is Russian roulette. But I think there's plenty of evidence of Chinese, what some people in this town like to call malign influence, both on the coercive and the less coercive side of things. So is this really a difference of tactics or is it a difference of fundamental objectives between the two?
I think it's a difference of intensity and it's a difference of objectives. Russia is a weak power that has no hope of displacing the United States as a leader of the international community and therefore seeks to weaken the order that the United States represents and heads. China has a reasonable aspiration of replacing the United States. It therefore seeks to shape that order with a view to ultimately replacing the United States as its leading power. That's one is a largely destructive agenda. The other is a constructive one, although one that represents a serious challenge to the United States.
So bringing the conversation back to Russia, what is your sense of what Russia's long-term objective is? I mean, is it really just sowing anarchy and chaos in the international system?
I think it is to weaken the system, to give itself more freedom of action, to increase its influence. It's largely a nostalgic set of objectives based on Russian imperial and Soviet history, a return to an earlier era. And I'm not sure it has a constructive or even a clear agenda other than as I've suggested.
Just to add a point to what Jim just said now, it's interesting. I think that Russia in the, 10 years ago might have harbored some more grand strategic objective. There was a speech that Vladimir Putin gave, I think in October of 2011, in which, and this is obviously before the annexation of Crimea and the attendant sanctions that have really crippled Russia's economy. But Vladimir Putin said in October 2011 that he envisioned, and this is also at a time when the price of oil was much higher than it is now, he said that he envisioned Russia as being a thriving economic intermediary between Western Europe and the Asia Pacific. But it's interesting, though, that he doesn't really, at least as far as I can gather, he doesn't talk in those grandiose terms now. I think that if given a sort of extant structural decline. If you look at their demographic outlook, they're declining coercive energy leverage. And if you also look at their diplomatic isolation in Western Europe, their increasingly supplicant relationship vis-a-vis China, my sense is that Russia feels that it stands to gain more influence in world affairs via destabilization than, as Jim was saying, they're trying to offer a constructive alternative.
I'm going to push back on this a little bit because I think that my own view on this is that Russia clearly dislikes the present international system, and I don't think there's much disagreement about the fact that it is a revisionist power vis-a-vis that system. At the same time, I think it's easy to overstate Russia's isolation. You know, if you look at the relationships it succeeded in cultivating not only in places like Syria and Venezuela, but even in Europe and in parts of the United States as well, I think there is a concerted attempt here to try and change the basic functioning of the system, probably in a more extensive way than China, but not simply to blow things up. I mean, if anything, Russia portrays itself, and you know, Jim, you talked about the imperial and Soviet legacies, right? Well, there is this notion that, that Nicholas I talked about in the 19th century of you know, Russia as the gendarme of Europe. And there seems to be something to that in terms of Russia's approach today, you know, supporting authoritarian regimes that it can use as proxies or allies, looking for politicians or movements that will at least be deferential to Russian interests in exchange for its support of them, trying to undermine existing alliances and institutions. And I think we haven't quite gotten to the next stage of that, which is, well, then what replaces them? And this is where I think this, you know, idea of Russia as a rogue, as a state that's trying to blow things up has a little bit of purchase. Because, Ali, I think you're right, we haven't really had the clear statement of what Russia seeks to replace this with. There was some discussion earlier about, you know, the Greater Eurasia Partnership or various kinds of integration schemes in the larger Eurasian space. For a variety of reasons, those seem to have gone, if not entirely by the wayside, but have been kind of downgraded in terms of their overall importance, even if they haven't entirely gone away. But I think that's still where a lot of the focus is. Now, whether this is the long-term state of affairs or whether there is going to be some, you know, shift towards a more visionary approach, whether under Putin or whatever comes next, of course, remains to be seen.
Look, a lot of what you say about Russia's relationships is right, but many of these are tactical. And I think you need to look at them in comparison with the other poles of power, the United States and China and the overall world system, right? The United States has true allies. Russia does not have true allies. The United States has NATO. The EU is still quite strong. Yes, Russia does have relationships with parties and with people throughout the EU. But I think if you were to talk to every EU country, at least the EU 27, they would still see their future in the EU. Now, it may be different for the euro, but certainly they see strength in staying with the EU, perhaps reforming it, perhaps changing it, but not breaking it apart. Likewise, if you look at global institutions, right? Yes, the Russia has a veto in the UN Security Council, but look at other global institutions, the architecture, the international system, the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank, right? It's not Russia that's a big player there, and Russia doesn't set the agenda there. Likewise, if you look at China, you know, China does not have allies the way the United States does, but China can assemble a Belt and Road Forum with dozens and dozens of countries coming, and China can assemble an Africa conference every 3 years and get heads of state. It can assemble the SCO. True, Russia's a part of that, but you know, we'd really look at that as China. Put together other global institutions, Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, New Development Bank. So compared to what could be its competitors or its friends, Russia really doesn't have the kinds of relationships that one would need to have a major positive influence on the global system.
Yeah, well, I think part of the issue here is that one thing that Russia does not have that the United States and China both do is a broad, diversified and growing economy. And that obviously limits its ability to shape some of these particularly economic institutions at the global level. And for that reason, you know, we talk about Russia, China, the United States as sort of the three great powers, but it's really kind of, you know, two and a half. I think where Russia is putting its emphasis is not so much on the economic levers of power so much as on kinetic measures, which obviously have a certain utility, at least within, you know, certain geographic bounds. And there I would argue it's been pretty effective. Now, you know, if Russia ends up sort of owning Syria because it's managing the political transition there, is that really a win or not? Is an open question. But I think there's a kind of different approach here based on the recognition that Russia doesn't have the kind of economic levers or resources that either Washington or Beijing have.
I think this paper is a reaction to the national security strategy. If you read the national security strategy, its definition of the Russian and Chinese challenge is identical. They make no distinction between the two at all.
Yeah.
And we're arguing that there are big distinctions between the two. Now, Russia likes certain aspects of the international system, but it doesn't like and isn't a main player in most of the important elements of the international system, and therefore sees a virtue in weakening them. China, rather, is an important member in a larger spectrum of international institutions, is not trying to undermine or destroy those institutions, but to shape them in China's interest.
Or to replace them.
No, I don't think China wants to replace the World Bank or the IMF. It certainly wants to compete with the Asian Development Bank, largely because the members of the Asian Development Bank weren't prepared to give China voting rights commensurate with its strength and potential contributions. That's hardly a malign influence. It's a source of competition. There's a difference between straight-up competition in which China behaves like the United States and we don't like it, and a competition in which another country seeks to undermine our basic institutions.
Which I think if you ask the Russians, they would say is also doing what the United States does. But that's maybe another conversation. One of the other sort of interesting implications of the national security strategy, since we brought it up, is that the nature of the Sino-Russian relationship is going to be a really important driver of future U.S. strategy and engagement with both countries. Where do you guys come down on the nature of that bilateral relationship and how it's changing?
It's a fairly unequal relationship. In part, I think Russia is looking to China because it has not been fully accepted by the United States and the West. And China can prove to be a good customer over the long term for Russian resources. So there's partly convenience, partly geostrategic, geopolitical reasons for the two to get together. It's a highly imbalanced relationship, though. Again, because Russia's demographic prospects are not good. Its economic prospects for now are not good. Whereas China also faces some headwinds, but it's in much better shape, much larger economy. And so you see the energy deals, China is bargaining hard with Russia. There are no favors being given. The two are cooperating on other issues. China is respecting Russia's equities in terms of security in Central Asia. And Russia seems to be respecting China's desires regarding economics in Central Asia. There's certainly more scope for cooperation, trade routes through Russia, Chinese activity in investment or other business activity in Russia could be helpful, but highly unequal, and there's no reason to think that it will change and become more equal over the medium term.
And just to add to Howard's point, I think that one of the paradoxes of the Sino-Russian relationship is that if you look at current trend lines, it is simultaneously becoming more robust across a range of dimensions and more asymmetric. So if you look at it's true. If you look at weapons sales or weapons transfers between the two countries, if you look at the rapport between President Xi and President Putin, the number of visits that President Xi has made to Russia, if you look at their trade, which just recently crossed $100 billion for two-way trading relationship, which crossed $100 billion for the first time. So if you take – if you look at those trends, you see an increasingly robust relationship. But as Howard was saying, the economic imbalance between the two continues to grow apace. And so in the early years after the Cold War, China's overall economic size and that of Russia were roughly comparable. Now China's economy, it's in aggregate terms, is roughly eight times as large as Russia's, and China's growth rate is roughly four times as fast as Russia's. And so my sense is that if the economic imbalance between the two continues to grow apace, and the trend suggests that it will, even if China experiences a deceleration of its growth, that you will have an increasingly asymmetric relationship in which China will become more and more the senior partner, Russia more and more the supplicant partner. So it's possible, and I think that the China-Russia relationship demonstrates this reality, that you can have a relationship that is increasingly robust but also increasingly asymmetric. What worries me is, and this goes to Jim's point about the kind of the conflation of the Chinese and Russian challenges that you see in both the national security strategy and the national defense strategy, is that while the present relationship is more a partnership of convenience than an alliance of consequence, a policy of dual containment or something approaching dual containment would be likely to hasten a transition or a maturation of the relationship from the former kind of partnership of convenience into the latter, namely an alliance of consequence. So it's not clear to me that the United States alone can blunt the momentum in Sino-Russian relations or hive China off of Russia or the other way around, but it can at least take steps to prevent an acceleration in their convergence, and that would be to avoid a posture of dual containment.
Yeah, I want to come back to the policy recommendations in a bit here. I think you're absolutely right about the way that the relationship has become both closer and more asymmetric in the last decade or so. I would argue that in part that is the result of the way in which relations between Russia and the West have gone completely off the rails. Russia, for a long time in the 1990s and the early 2000s, was very worried about this potential for an asymmetric relationship with China and was engaged in a policy of trying to balance economically and in security terms between China on the one hand, the West on the other. I think we've really seen an acceleration of the embrace of China since 2014, since the imposition of sanctions, which almost seems to be a strategic decision on the Russian part, that we're in a long-term confrontation with the United States, the European Union, and our only way of getting through this is to accept this kind of unequal relationship with China. So there is a sense in which Western policy and the development of the relationship with the West is kind of the third pillar of this relationship.
That's right. But in some ways, Russia has put itself in its own box. The Western relationship with Russia, certainly post-Ukraine, has reasons. Right?
Yeah.
Russia took the territory of what is considered a European country, and that's just beyond the pale for Europe and for the United States and under principles of the global system. Russia would certainly benefit by a stronger relationship with the West. A lot of what can be done to do that is really up to Russia. So, Russians will also look back to the 1990s, which were bad for Russia. And, it is true that the West made mistakes, Russian policymakers made mistakes. In part, we don't have very good knowledge of how to restore or rescue collapsing empires. It just doesn't happen that often, right? So everyone was dealing in a period of great uncertainty, and oil price trends certainly didn't help either. So
I can think of another collapsing empire that needs rescuing right now.
So
that's another story.
I would say one other thing about the Russia-China relationship. In some ways, Russia has to have the same concerns that the U.S. and the West does regarding its technology, right? Yeah. China is certainly interested in upgrading its military technology. I don't think it really cares where those upgrades come from. And to the extent that Russian military equipment and technology is more advanced than China, Russia should rightfully have some concerns there. So there are – that's just one, but there are certainly many areas of interest where Russia and the West could find accord. But unfortunately right now, largely because of Russian actions, those avenues are much more narrow than they could be.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I feel that Russia was the West mishandled policy toward Russia in the 90s and early years of this decade, of this century, and pushed Russia into a position in which it crossed certain lines, which it's very difficult to back away from. I think there is a prospect, probably under new leadership in Washington and probably under new leadership in Moscow, to amend the relationship and to reattract Russia to a more positive relationship with Europe and the United States. I think it's difficult with Putin, who's identified with the hard line, with the seizure of Crimea and the continued insurgency in eastern Ukraine. And it's impossible with President Trump, who faces a Congress that doesn't trust him on Russian policy and effectively paralyzes the U.S. in this respect. And that's going to continue for the duration of this administration, I'm afraid. But I think there is a prospect in the longer term for some new equilibrium in that relationship. It's even conceivable that you would have sort of the reverse Nixon goes to China. China was the weak partner at that time and was detached from the senior partner, the Soviet Union. And one could conceive of a situation in which Russia was detached from China, but not at the price of accepting aggression and seizure of foreign territory. And so I think there are big hurdles to get over before one could achieve that.
Yeah, I think there were some people in Trump's orbit, at least early in the administration, who had that very idea. And that, apart from, you know, whatever kinds of collusion or whatever you want to call it, explains some of the fascination with Russia that exists in certain circles in the Trump administration. One of the differences, though, apart from Trump himself, is that in 1969, the Soviet Union and China nearly went to war over a disputed border. And that was the context within which Nixon went to China. For all the tensions in the Sino-Russian relationship now, I don't think there's kind of an equivalent sense of crisis that would encourage either power to be open to that kind of diplomatic revolution. Now, of course, under new leadership in Moscow, that could change, and in Washington for that matter. But I think, you know, sometimes we get into this. We look back fondly on the sort of Nixon to China model, and I think in the long term there is some opportunity there precisely because of the unbalanced nature of the Sino-Russian relationship that we talked about. But it's going to be, I think, more complicated in some ways than Nixon going to China.
And just to elaborate on that point, and also to elaborate on Jim's point about the long-term potential of this hiving off or some kind of U.S. Russia condominium to counterbalance China. I think that there could be a possibility in the long term, but I think that Russia would have to render at least one of two judgments, and I would argue that they would have to render both judgments in order to decide with the United States in this variant of triangular diplomacy. The first judgment that Russia would have to render is that the long term strategic risks of an increasingly asymmetric relationship with China outweigh the potential upside. So that would be conclusion one or judgment one.
That's right.
And I think the second judgment is that even in the 1990s and I think in the early 2000s, the United States still had this perhaps triumphalist conclusion that, you know, Russia, whatever its woes in the 1990s and whatever sense of aggrievement it felt against the post-war order, that Russia still viewed itself as a principally European country, that it sought to reintegrate itself into the West. I think that Russia would have to conclude that its long-term, the more reliable long-term path towards restoring some of its influence would lie in attempting or undertaking to reintegrate itself into the West as opposed to deepening its relationship with China. And again, given the growing inequities, particularly economic, in the relationship between China and Russia, it's possible in the long term that Russia might render one or both of those judgments. But I agree with Jim that in the short term, and particularly given the leadership right now in Washington and Moscow, that those judgments seem unlikely.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would just add one other thing, which is that if Russia itself transforms to the point where it can be more of an equal player in this triangular relationship and have more confidence in its ability to maneuver between Washington and Beijing, then it might be more capable of making that kind of a judgment. But as long as it's kind of a question of are you reliant on the one or are you reliant on the other, where Moscow is more the object than the subject, then it's harder. Let's get back to the question of, as every Russianist likes to put it, что делать, what is to be done. So, given the nature of the three-way relationship that we've talked about, and given the parallel but not congruent challenges that China and Russia pose to U.S. interests, how does Washington effectively manage that scenario, that situation?
Well, in the report, what we recommend is a return to an updated version of the Cold War instruments of defense, deterrence, reassurance of allies, and arms control, an updating which requires factoring in the ubiquity and power of the internet and the necessity of defense, deterrence, and reassurance in that sphere, as well as the more conventional strategic and conventional arms spheres.
Yeah, that one's going to be tough. I think we're still trying to get our heads around exactly how that would operate. And the other piece of it, having participated in a lot of these dialogues with Russians, is that we view Russian interference in our elections as a violation of sovereignty and as something that can't be allowed to stand and that is a fundamental impediment to sort of normalization. Russia looks at a lot of the things that we've done within the Russian political system, again, going back to the 1990s, support for independent media, democracy promotion, NGOs, declarative and other kinds of support for protesters as being of the same ilk. And so, you know, we think about Russian interference in one way. Russians think about American interference in a fundamentally different way. And I don't know how you have a conversation about ways forward on this question of interference in a way that allows you to get to some kind of rules of the road.
I could question use of the term Russians in arguing that all Russians feel that way. U.S. behavior in the 90s, support for civil society, independent media, democracy, were all supported by the Russian government. American Radio Free Europe was allowed to broadcast from Russia. So it's not as if this was done over Russian objections. It wasn't a clandestine or covert or even a confidential effort at manipulating a society. It was an effort condoned by the Russian government and by many Russian people to try to move the society in a given direction. Now, now of course, you have a different leadership and a different set of desires, and how you characterize that leadership's view is correct. And it may represent at this point a view of most Russian people, although it's hard to know. I think that, first of all, we're doing almost nothing in terms of an ideological campaign in Russia at the moment, partly because we're not allowed
to. We've been kicked out.
And partly because we're not investing. I don't think the CIA has a large program of supporting Russian dissident institutions. I don't think that we're using the internet aggressively to try to undermine support for the Russian state. I don't think we're penetrating Russian cyber defenses and spilling out secrets about where Putin's money is and where his cronies' resources are. I think we could do all those things. And I think if we did them for a while, it might become the basis for a truce in which there's some modus vivendi in which we agree on what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable. But as long as we're passive in this regard and rely purely on our defenses, our domestic defenses against Russian interference, I think we're going to be at a disadvantage.
Yeah, it's the old debate about deterrence by denial or deterrence by punishment.
Right.
And I think there's probably aspects of both.
Right.
But I think we're still a long way from being able to conceptualize what a truce would look like.
Yeah, I agree. But we're not even trying.
Yeah. On the arms control piece, I know this is another area where we've traditionally done it in the bilateral context, but now with the emergence of China, it's more of a multilateral or at least trilateral question. Do you have thoughts about how to sort of approach arms control in a world in which it's not just the US and Russia?
It probably depends on the sphere you're talking about. If you were talking about space, for instance, I would think it would be necessary to involve China in an ASAT treaty, for instance. In terms of nuclear arms, China maintains a minimal deterrent. Last thing we want to do is encourage China to compete with the United States and the Soviet and Russia in the nuclear sphere. So in terms of actual, equal and lower limits, it's really only still a U.S.-Russian game. Conventional arms, again, I think this is largely a European concern. I think a conventional arms agreement that tried to encompass China would become virtually global in scope. At least it would include all of Asian countries and be pretty unmanageable.
Do you guys have thoughts on the sort of where do we go from here aspect?
I mean, I would just add on, not so much on just Russia narrowly, but just at the broader triangle. It's not a particularly satisfying conclusion or particularly revelatory conclusion. But I do think we need to think about pursuing tailored and differentiated approaches to China and Russia. When I look at China, I see a country that is a resurgent, increasingly global power. It's more selectively revisionist, whereas when you look at Russia, it is in many ways structurally declining, and it's more of a short-term proximate challenge, and it's more opportunistically obstructive. And the way in which you deal with a selectively revisionist power and an opportunistically obstructive one, I think those strategies have to be different. So that would be the first one. The second is that
term, opportunistically obstructive.
Because if you look at their, I think if you look at their different vectors of effort, I think it's fair to say that Russia is particularly under Vladimir Putin. I think that Russia is certainly has demonstrated tactical agility. But it's not clear. We sometimes see these depictions in Western and particularly in American media that Putin is playing multidimensional chess and that he is a strategic grandmaster. But when I think of
somebody please tell me what multidimensional chess actually is.
I don't know what it is either. But I think if you look at Russia's various vectors of effort and that Jim discussed earlier, so propping up Assad in Syria, conducting disinformation operations, hiving off territory in its near abroad, those various efforts certainly have shored up Russian influence in a destabilizing sense. But whether or not those efforts actually have made Russia a more have increased Russia's overall base of power is a separate question. So again, when I look at kind of the 30,000-foot view, I see Russia that despite some of the transactional partnerships it's forming, it still is more diplomatically isolated today than it was in Western Europe than it was, say, 10 years ago. It doesn't have the same type of coercive energy leverage it used to have. It's more of a supplicant to China. And also, I mean, China has, as a resurgent economic power, China has the the economic wherewithal to envision credibly a unified Eurasian economic zone at which, you know, China sits at the center. Russia doesn't have the economic wherewithal to harbor a comparable set of aspirations. And so it's a long-winded way of saying that, you know, again, the Chinese and Russian challenges are very different. And even though I suspect that their relationship will continue to progress, and even though in the short term it doesn't seem that we'll be able to pursue a kind of variant of triangular diplomacy, we at least should avoid taking steps that accelerate the accelerate their extant convergence.
Yeah, I think that's the bottom line for an effective strategy. I mean, what does that entail?
It's not clear what specific steps should be taken because it's not clear what Russia will want to do, right? Part of the issue for Russia is it is clearly in Russia's economic interest to have closer relationships with Europe, with the United States. You know, in terms of market size, the U.S. and Europe are still the largest markets in the world. China is a great source of imports for many countries. It is not the best target destination for final exports. So even if Russia has any hope of diversifying its economy, it will need those Western links. Investment, people often speak about China's large investment plans on Belt and Road. That's really lending for the most part. China invests in the West. It invests in Europe and has tried to invest in the United States, although that's fallen somewhat. So Russia can't necessarily look to China for large-scale investment, at least the investment it would need. The issue then is, you know, Russia would like the sanctions off. Russia can benefit by access to Western markets. Russia can benefit by access to Western technology, even in its hydrocarbon sector. So exploitation of deep water will benefit from the West. So it comes back to what Russia is willing to do, right? Clearly, Europe and the United States and other countries who have put sanctions on Russia will want to or should slowly remove those sanctions as Russia meets the terms of the sanctions, right? And it should be very clear that that will happen so that Russia doesn't come to believe that it has no outs and that it's completely boxed in.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the dangers of where we are right now, particularly with the momentum for sanctions lying mostly in Congress. Because if you look at the way that sanctions are being – sanctions bills are being drafted, there's more stick than carrot. And it's unclear sort of what the out is. Certainly the sanctions that were passed over the annexation of Crimea, that's pretty clear. You know, you get out of Crimea, these sanctions go away. You implement the Minsk agreement, these sanctions go away. But what we've seen more recently, it's unclear what that out is. And I worry, precisely for the reasons that you outlined, that what they're doing is making it harder to envision some kind of shift in the way that Russia views and approaches the United States, and just deepening the belief that even if it's an unequal relationship, China is where the future lies.
Right. That's a strong argument for U.S. sanctions being held within executive order rather than legislation. Now, most of the legislation usually has an out, right? But this goes back to a point Jim made earlier, right? If the administration exercises that out, what will then happen with relations between the administration and Congress? So it is a very difficult situation, especially if some of the newer proposed laws do in fact become law.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of the irony of having an administration that came into power in this country with the idea that it was going to improve relations with Russia, actually presiding over a deepening of the confrontation.
And just on this point, I mean, one of the challenges with both – and I know that you wanted to move more towards what, you know, what should the United States do and what should it – towards policy prescriptions. But I'm going to evade that one more time and just add another problem, but one that came to mind as we were talking. I do think that the challenge – one of the challenges that the United States faces vis-a-vis China as well as Russia is that there's a short-term goal of arresting the downward momentum in both our relationship with Russia and with China. But there's less of a clear sense, at least as far as I can gather, less of a clear sense of what it is that the United States hopes for its long-term equilibrium to be in So first of all, you know, with China, how do we define China? Yes, it is increasingly competitive in a range of domains, but the United States and China do also have a number of interdependencies. So they have a two-way trading relationship that runs in the hundreds of billions of dollars. China accounts for roughly one-third of all international students at American institutions of higher learning. So China is not an unalloyed antagonist in the way that the Soviet Union was, even though it's increasingly competitive. So how do we classify China? What long-term equilibrium do we seek? And with Russia, while there are fewer evident arenas of cooperation, at least under the present leadership in Washington and Moscow, I think the most American and Russian observers would say that some kind of equilibrium between the two countries is beneficial, but the contours remain unclear. And so right now, beyond saying that we want to arrest the downward spiral in momentum between in U.S.-Russia relations and in U.S.-China relations, thinking beyond that short term and saying what would a constructive, durable equilibrium look like with both countries, I suspect it remains quite elusive right now.
Yeah, to bring it back to the national security strategy, I mean, I've said this on several occasions. This is my biggest criticism of the national security strategy, is that it says the United States needs to compete with Russia and China. These are the biggest challenges to the long-term security interests of the United States. But it doesn't provide a vision of where we want to go in that relationship. It just says we have to compete. But compete towards what end? What is the final end game? And what does that three-way relationship ultimately look like? And what is the United States prepared to negotiate about? I think that's the other piece that we still are trying to work our heads around. You know, what sorts of things that are in the ambitions of Beijing or Moscow do we consider acceptable or at least negotiable, and which do we not? I think that's going to be probably a challenge for the next administration.
Yeah, I mean, your basic question was how do we avoid driving the two together? And the first stage in that process is not to conceive or describe the relationships in ways that conflate the two, as we've suggested. With China, the competition is largely economic, certainly as regards our European allies. It's entirely economic. There are sort of traditional security and geopolitical aspects to the Asian relationships with China. But the global challenge to China in Africa, in Latin America, and in Europe, and the Belt and Road is a geoeconomic, and the response is appropriately an economic response.
Yeah.
And in an economic response, it's never a win-lose proposition. It's how to craft it so that both sides gain advantage. And that's not impossible.
Yeah.
With Russia, it's largely a geopolitical challenge in the traditional sense, but with a much weaker adversary. The positive carrots ought to be on the table, as well as the more traditional negative responses. But categorizing the two, arguing they're both malign, arguing they're both trying to undermine our democracy. China's not trying to undermine our democracy. Russia uses its influence, its malign influence, in order to weaken democratic structures. China just wants to uses its influence to influence foreign policy. You know, there's a lot of attention to Chinese influence in Australia, yeah, where they've done, but they're not trying to undermine Australian democracy.
They're trying to make it work for them.
No, well, they're trying to influence Australian foreign policy, which is a more legitimate objective, even if some of the instruments are not so benign. So I think making these distinctions is an important starting point to disaggregating this threat.
Yeah, I think that's really important, and I think you guys have done a service by producing a report that allows us to at least separate the two and think about them in different ways. So I hope you've gotten a good response. I hope you get some constructive feedback, and hopefully we'll have some influence in terms of thinking about how we deal with this challenge. So, Jens, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you for joining us for another episode of Russian Roulette. There are links to Ambassador Dobbins, Howard's, and Ali's bios in the show notes. You can also access some of their recent publications there. For all of you who haven't done so already, you really should consider subscribing to Russian Roulette on iTunes, where you can also leave us a rating and a review. And if you don't use iTunes, you can check us out and subscribe on Google Play or SoundCloud. Sign up, listen, keep spreading the word. And of course, this is your biweekly reminder to send us mailbag questions. You can email them to rep@csis.org and put the words Russian Roulette in the subject line. We look forward to hearing from you, and we're going to do another mailbag segment here shortly. You can also follow us on Twitter at @CSIS Russia, and you can follow me at Dr. J. Mankoff. And of course, as always, big thank you to everybody who works so hard to make the podcast happen every 2 weeks. That includes our producer, research associate, and program manager, Cyrus Newland, and the whole CSIS External Relations and iLab team. Thanks for listening. See you again, or talk to you again, in 2 weeks.